Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 175, Interview with D.B. Jackson. This episode is brought to you by the new Kickstarter project, Tome of Ideas for Writers and Roleplayers. Supported today by going to adventuresinscifipublishing.com and clicking on the icon for Tome of Ideas.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell. Now, many of you have already submitted your entries to win a free copy of Thief Taker by D.B. Jackson, published by Tor Books. Five copies are up for grabs, so get your entry in while you still can. Details are on the website. Kat Richardson describes Thief Taker as a beautiful balance of magic and crime, history and fantasy that is fast-paced, compelling, and completely absorbing. And today, we are joined by the author of Thief Taker, known for today as D.B. Jackson. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's nice to be here.
I'll explain that little comment I made later on. But for now, let's jump into the book. And I would really love it if you could just start us off by telling us about the story and about the characters of Thief Taker.
Well, Thief Taker is what I call a historical urban fantasy. It's set in colonial Boston in the years leading up to the American Revolution. My lead character is a thief taker, which is a sort of 18th century private detective. Thief takers were real. They were a phenomenon that existed mostly in England, although there were some thief takers in the New World in the early 19th century. There were none in colonial Boston. That's kind of a historical conceit of the book. But my lead character is a thief taker. He is also a conjurer. He can cast spells. His name is Ethan Kale, and he is drawn into a murder mystery as the book begins on the night of the Stamp Act riots in Boston in 1765. And as he investigates this murder, he's drawn into a political conspiracy. He is dogged by his rival thief taker, the beautiful and dangerous Sapphira Price, and he needs to basically track down another conjurer who's responsible for the killing before this conjurer returns the favor and tracks him down. And that's the basic outline of the story. I can certainly tell you more in response to questions.
That was really good.
Thank you.
I love it when an author has the, 1 to 2 minute description actually prepared and rehearsed. So thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Now, did you say, so thief takers were an actual thing?
Thief takers were an actual thing. Let me give you a little background on this if you're interested. The
Please.
Idea for the series came to me when I was reading a history book about, of all places, Australia. My wife and I were about to move there for a year because she had a sabbatical, and she was taking her sabbatical in Australia. And I read this book called The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes. And, of course, Australia started as a penal colony for the British Empire. And so the book spent some time talking about British criminal investigations and law enforcement and stuff like that. And there was a footnote, a discursive footnote about a man named Jonathan Wild, who was the thief taker extraordinaire of London in the early 18th century. And what made Wild special was that he was actually responsible for the vast majority of the crimes he eventually solved. He would steal from people, sell the goods that he could at the highest profit, and then return the rest for a finder's fee. And so he grew very rich, and people thought, wow, this guy can solve any crime, it seems like. And so he became this kind of folk hero. And he had a long and, you know, illustrious career as a thief taker until he was finally found out and hanged at the ripe old age of 27. And so I read this footnote about him, and I thought, okay, I need to write a book about thief takers. And so this is actually odd for me. Usually my stories begin with, as an idea, with a protagonist. But in this case, they began with a Jonathan Wild type character who is, in fact, the nemesis of my protagonist, this woman I mentioned, Saphira Price. But that's how the story began. So thief takers were real. They just weren't in colonial Boston as I have them in this book.
That is so interesting. I've never heard of this before. The character, the nemesis character, Price, right?
Yes.
Does she also create her own schemes that she has to solve?
Yes. Yeah. In Thief Taker, she is a similar character. She kind of is responsible for many of the crimes, but that she solves. But because she manages to solve the crimes, many of the elite in Boston think of her as kind of this celebrity crime fighter who can do anything, and she's referred to as the Empress of the South End because she lives in the South End of Boston. But she is every bit the criminal that Jonathan Wild was, and she was an amazingly fun character to write.
What's interesting about this, now that I know that Thief Takers actually existed, and now that I know that she is actually setting up the crimes that she's going to solve, it already had sort of a mobster feel to it in the terms of there's territories. And, like, this is her territory. And I was reading the first chapter, and he, Ethan, is, you know, intruding on Boston, which is her territory. And, of course, there's obviously this crime element to the book. Was that at all in play when you were putting the book together, that idea of this mobster territory and the mob?
Well, the territory that she seeks to protect from Ethan and the kind of the source of their conflict throughout not only this book but subsequent volumes in the series is not so much a physical territory. Boston, she's located in the South End, but she operates in all parts of Boston, and Ethan does too. But she has kind of declared herself the thief taker for Boston's wealthiest clientele. So as long as Ethan is doing kind of two-bit crimes and working for shillings instead of pounds or crowns, she's fine. What happens in this book is he is hired by someone who's very wealthy, and she doesn't like that at all, and so that's the source of their immediate conflict in Thief Taker.
Okay, cool. There are a lot of different elements going on in the book. If you had to put your thumb on one, is Thief Taker more fantasy, crime, political intrigue, or historical novel?
Wow. I would really hate to have to choose, because all of those things play such prominent roles in the book. I think, fundamentally, it is a fantasy novel. My character is a conjurer. That's what sets him apart. He is doing battle with another conjurer in this book, and will be as well in its sequels. So that magical element is very strong. But by the same token, we meet Samuel Adams, we meet other historical figures who are slightly less well-known but equally important. There is obviously a hugely important mystery element to the book. The political stuff plays a big role. So all of those things come to play in large measure, but primarily, I'm a fantasy author. I always have been. I love playing with magic, and this book is no exception.
You mentioned that Ethan is a conjurer, and you were just talking about the fantasy elements. So could you tell us a little bit about the magic system and how the magic works? I know Ethan's forearms reveal quite a price for using his abilities, so maybe you could tell us how this works.
Yeah, sure. It's a complicated magic system, and I wanted it to be such. I wanted it to demand a lot of my character and to be something that was not easy at any juncture in the book. So there are several types of magic, and those conjurers who can do magic refer to them in three broad categories. There is elemental magic, which is basically what it sounds like. You can do spells that are sourced in air, water, fire, earth, and these tend to be the weakest of the spells. They're basically illusion spells, so that you can conjure something that people see or hear that isn't real, but it has the magic has no physical, real physical manifestation. Then there's what they call living magic, and this is what you're referring to with Ethan. This is magic that is sourced in some living thing, whether it's grass or bark and leaves from a tree, or more powerfully, human blood. And so a lot of times when Ethan conjures, he needs to cut his forearm and source the magic in the blood that flows from his veins. And then finally, there is what's called killing magic. And again, this is exactly what it sounds like. You can kill a person or an animal and base the magic in that source, in that person's life, and you get a very, very powerful spell. If blood magic can bring a trickle of water from a stone, killing magic can cause a deluge and a rainstorm. So, you know, that's the type of exponential increase you get when you take a life. There are four elements to the magic: the conjurer, him or herself, the source that I was just talking about. When Ethan conjures, a ghost appears at his side, and this ghost is kind of a spirit guide who allows him to access magic, which dwells at this boundary between the living world and the realm of the dead. And then finally, there's an invocation that has to be done in Latin in order for the spell to take effect. So, very complicated magic system, but again, I wanted to have the Latin in it because I wanted it to be tied slightly to the predominant religions of the day, which were still doing masses in Latin. I wanted to have the ghostly element and the blood element because magic is equated with witchcraft, and so conjurers are persecuted in this time and place in which I'm writing. And so I wanted those elements in there to make it seem more like witchcraft and to make that equation in people's minds make sense to my 21st century readers.
Can you tell us more about the ghost that appears for Ethan? Was this an actual historical figure? Is the ghost an entity that lives in a parallel dimension of some sort? How does that work?
The ghost is the ghost never speaks. So a large amount of what Ethan knows or thinks he knows about the ghost is kind of conjecture. But he assumes that the ghost is an ancestor of his, someone in his family line who was also a conjurer in his day, and who, as I said, serves as this conduit for Ethan to access the power that he uses for his spells. And every conjurer has a different ghost that is also someone from his or her familial past. This particular ghost Ethan calls Uncle Reg because the ghost reminds Ethan of his mother's brother, who was kind of a nasty, waspish man who he never liked, and his ghost is kind of persnickety, and Ethan's relationship with him is a little tense at times, and it makes for a fun dynamic. But so he refers to him as Uncle Reg or just Reg.
So does Ethan have control of the ghost, or do they have a relationship where they have to work together?
A little of both. Ethan can summon the ghost, and the ghost has to respond, but. And pretty much if Ethan casts a spell, the ghost has to give him access to the magic. So in that way, the ghost is tied to Ethan's will. But as readers will see when they read the first book, and particularly the second book, the ghost is not always a willing or happy participant in Ethan's conjurings. And he makes his displeasure known pretty clearly. And spells don't always go just right. So there are times when perhaps Reg isn't trying his hardest to make the spell work.
You mentioned killing magic. And so, David, I grew up with dogs, and I love dogs. And did you really have to do the dog like that? Oh, can we talk about that? Is that too much of a spoiler?
That's a bit of a spoiler. I'd rather not talk about it. Okay. It was a very, very hard thing to do. But it also provides one of the emotional touchstones of the entire book. You know, without giving away too much, it's a moment when Ethan is forced to recognize that he's not nearly as different from the person he's pursuing as perhaps he thought he was. And that's a serious moment in the book.
It was, because my wife, I told you when this book arrived from tour, she immediately took it away from me. And so good timing. She had just finished what she was reading when it came in. And she just finished it a couple days ago. She can only read, really, before she goes to bed. So to finish a book in a couple of weeks is, you know, you're keeping her up at night. And she has to get up at 3:30 in the morning. So that's saying something.
Okay, I'm sorry. You winked out for a moment there. What I heard you say, so to read a book in a couple of, and then you stopped.
Yeah, so she has to get up at 3:30 5 days a week. So for her to finish a book in a couple of weeks when she can only read right before bedtime, that means you're actually keeping her awake. And that's not easy to do when she's been up for, you know, 17 hours. So, but I'm like, hey, well, what's wrong? She's like, look what happened.
Did I reduce her to tears?
She was pretty upset about it. Yeah, I don't know if she actually cried, but she was not pleased.
Was she mad at me?
No, she wasn't mad. She was moved.
Okay. Okay.
Put it that way. Yeah. So okay. I won't get into the details. Obviously, we don't want to spoil it, but at least people know there's something in there.
Yeah.
To be waiting for. But yeah, that would be hard to write, I imagine, especially if you like animals.
Yeah, it was.
You mentioned Sam Adams, Boston Logger. All right. Could you tell us who some of the other historical characters are that actually work their way into the book, either directly or indirectly?
Yeah, sure. One of them, and this is a historical figure who few people actually know about, but he was a fascinating figure. His name was Ebenezer McIntosh, and no, I did not make up that name. He was a cordwainer, a shoemaker, and he was also a leader of a South End Boston gang that used to fight with a North End Boston gang every year on what's called Pope's Day, also known as Guy Fawkes Day, which is a commemoration of a plot to blow up Parliament back in the 17th century. And for some reason, this day captured the imagination of British subjects throughout the New World, and to some degree in England as well. And there would be street battles every November 6th. And Ebenezer McIntosh was the leader of the South End street fighters. But he also became an important figure in revolutionary circles because he was able to mobilize kind of the working class, who people like Sam Adams and James Otis and others in the Sons of Liberty were less able to relate to because they were kind of more middle and upper class. And so Ebenezer McIntosh really did lead the Stamp Act riots in August of 1765, just as he does in my book. And he really was imprisoned very briefly for it because so much damage was done to people's homes. But as in my book, he basically gets off because they couldn't get people to testify against him. So Ebenezer McIntosh plays a role. Thomas Hutchinson, who is the lieutenant governor of Massachusetts and a strong loyalist, plays a role in the book and in the Stamp Act riots of 1765. His house sustained more damage than any other, and he had to flee in the middle of the night and hide his daughters and his wife in at his second home in Milton, Massachusetts, because he was so afraid that he was going to be killed by the mob that was abroad in the city. So he plays a role. James Otis, another of Sam Adams' allies, plays a role. Benjamin Church, who was a revolutionary and who later proved to be a traitor to the revolutionary cause, makes an appearance in the book. So there are lots of people in there, and then there are even more in the second book. You get some of the British military who come to occupy Boston. They play a role in the second book. So there are historical figures all over the place, and it was really fun weaving together the historical and the fictional throughout my work on the on the novel.
So, David, obviously, I haven't had a chance to read through the book yet since my wife took it. But is it more alternative history, or is it true to the actual historical timeline? And the story is just something that we didn't know was happening, running alongside it.
The history elements of the novel really do follow historical events quite closely. as closely as I could possibly do it. And what I've done is I've superimposed a murder mystery on top of the historical story, and so brought the two together, and I have my characters getting involved with the murder, with the historical stuff, and the historical figures getting involved in the murder investigation. Mm. But the strict history surrounding what happened with the Stamp Act riots and their immediate aftermath is as close to factual as I could get it.
Okay, cool. One thing that was cool for you writing this is you have a PhD in American history, so you didn't have to do like tons of research because you knew it all already.
Well, actually, I had to do a tremendous amount of research. My specialty was 20th century U.S. history.
Oh,
so I had to do a lot of research. But by the same token, it was, as you say, I have a PhD in history, and I spent 6 years of my life doing academic work and getting my degree and doing teaching and stuff like that. And it was nice to kind of finally connect these two threads of my professional life. Mm-hmm. I had given up on history some time ago and had turned totally to writing fantasy and was writing epic alternate world fantasy, which obviously doesn't have a lot of need for U.S. history knowledge. But being able to turn around and finally blend those two interests made this a very special project for me.
This episode is brought to you by the Kickstarter campaign Tome of Ideas for Writers and Roleplayers by Michael J. Weiniger. Tome of Ideas is part genre encyclopedia, part RPG book, part writing prompt collection, and part inspirational art book. It is designed as a resource for writers looking for their next story, game masters looking for their next adventure, or anyone who simply wants to sit down and send their imagination on a journey into speculative fiction. Contributors include over 20 award-winning and best-selling authors who will help provide writing prompts and story ideas to get you started on your next adventure. For more information, please go to Kickstarter.com and search for Tome of Ideas, or come to AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com and click on the image you'll find on the homepage for Tome of Ideas, a new Kickstarter campaign by Michael J. Weiniger. Let's go ahead and switch gears for a second here. And we mentioned earlier that as of today, you're D.B. Jackson, but you have been published quite successfully under David B. Coe. And you just mentioned the fantasy novels that you write as David B. Coe. And I'm just curious, your degree in history, though your specialty is 20th century American, obviously you've studied all different periods of history to get a degree, a PhD like that. How beneficial is that to you when you're putting together an epic fantasy novel or series?
It was actually more more helpful than my last remark might have indicated. I was kind of being a little glib there. But the fact is, having the historical degree has served me pretty well throughout my career, both as an epic fantasy writer and now as a historical fantasy writer. My degree is actually it's U.S. history, but it's also environmental history. And I spent a lot of time studying not only conservation policy, but also ways in which the natural environment influenced human behavior. And so that really came in handy as I was creating maps and creating economic systems and working out historical phenomenon in my imagined worlds, because I had a really good grounding in ways in which geography and climate and all those physical environmental factors work together with humans to shape the course of events, be they political or economic or social. So in that way, it was very helpful. And also, just writing a dissertation is an exercise in endurance and will. And I think that writing that dissertation years and years ago, though it nearly killed me, really did prepare me for a career in which I was going to have to turn out written material on a regular basis and meeting deadlines and all of that stuff. So I think my degree served me very well in a number of ways.
Do you still work in academia, or are you working as a full-time novelist?
I'm a full-time novelist. I still do, occasionally I do lectures at the university here where I live, where my wife is a college professor. but I do mostly, most of the teaching and such that I do now is much more fiction related. It's writing related. I haven't done as much teaching of history or lecturing in history in the past few years as I used to. And I can't say that I really miss it. I enjoy teaching writing far more than I enjoyed teaching history, and I enjoy writing fantasy far more than I ever enjoyed writing history.
The big question for me always is, why did you decide to do this under a different name?
It was really, it's a branding issue. David B. Coe readers are used to a certain kind of book. They're used to long chihuahua-killing epic fantasies.
Chihuahua-killing.
Chihuahua-killing. That's an industry term. If you drop a hardback from shoulder height onto the head of a chihuahua, if the book is big enough to kill the chihuahua, that is, in fact, a big, fat fantasy.
Now, David, why are we going back to the dog thing?
I mean, really? No, I'm sorry. There I am, back. People are really going to get the wrong idea about me. I do love animals. I love dogs. I really do. I used to have a dog who I loved very much. So I write, my readers are used to these big fantasies, alternate world, multiple point of view, multiple plot threads running through the book, lots of castle intrigue and high magic and stuff like that. And Thieftaker is a very different beast. It's not only historical, it's really got that that mystery element, kind of a noir voice to it. There's people have compared the book to kind of a blend of Sherlock Holmes and Raymond Chandler, and you know, because there really is that sense of, even with the 18th century vernacular, there's an edginess, a hard-boiled quality to the book. And that was intentional. I wanted that, and I wanted it to have that urban fantasy feel to it. The book is a standalone mystery. Each book in the Thieftaker series will be a standalone, so that there isn't that sense of you have to read all five books in order to understand the series or anything like that. And it's a single point of view. The plot is much more streamlined. It's a leaner book in almost every way, whether it's stylistic or genre classification, point of view. It's a different sort of book, and Tor felt very strongly that we should do it under a different name to keep the two brands separate. And I've been fine with it, and D.B. Jackson is getting a lot of attention, and the book is doing well, and so it seems to have worked.
Can you talk about how difficult it was to actually change the voice in which you were writing? I've heard some authors say that it's easy for them to do. I've heard some authors say you can't do it, that you know, you have your voice and you have to be true to it. What are your thoughts on that as you just went through this process of writing something that was so different than what you had been writing before?
Well, that's a really good question. I think there are two elements to it, and let me address both in turn. The first element of it is a character issue. A lot of voice, particularly in a close third-person point of view novel like Thieftaker, a lot of the voice is tied to my character. And so Ethan Cale is a different sort of character from anyone I've written before. He's older. He's more mature. He's served in prison. He came back from prison lame and scarred. He lost the one love he ever had. He's an exile from his family. He's kind of a loner. And so he's a difficult character. He's also, I think, a very compelling character. But his voice was utterly unique. And writing in that voice forced me to kind of take on a persona unlike any I had taken on before. And so in a way, that element of the voice took care of itself. There was no way Ethan's story was going to sound like the story of anyone else I've ever written. And so it was going to be unique no matter what. That said, there's the other element of it, and it's what I would call kind of genre voice. There is a different voice for urban fantasy than there is for epic fantasy. Epic fantasy tends to sound slightly more formalistic. There is, people speak to each other in ways that are somewhat stiff and old-fashioned. I think it's a residue of Tolkien that kind of seeps into all of our writing in high fantasy. And with Ethan and his cohort in Thieftaker, I really had to fight my epic fantasy pedigree, because I found myself slipping into that high fantasy voice again and again, and kind of having to kick myself and say, no, this is urban, and you need to take that flowery language you just used and pare it down and make it harder and edgier and leaner. And, you know, there were times when the urban fantasy voice flowed really nicely. The second book was much easier in this way than the first. But there were also times when I had to kind of correct myself and go back through for 20 or 30 pages and say, yeah, you slipped into the old voice there. You really need to fix that. So I don't agree with the idea that you can't do it, but it certainly did present challenges and ones that were at times a little tough for me.
That brings to mind a question. I want to follow up on that. Just looking at some of the newer writers of high fantasy, and you know, I know you can get into the distinctions between high fantasy and epic fantasy and all these different subgenres of fantasy. Mm-hmm. But looking at like Brandon Sanderson, Brent Weeks, James Ng all come to mind, who are writing these epic fantasies, but their characters speak in a very modern American way. They even use sometimes using slang that you would associate with, you know, a 25-year-old American. And I found that when, as I started reading their work over the last couple of years, at first a little, not off-putting, but I noticed it. I was like, oh, that's different. They're not, they're not so thee and thou. And obviously not, most authors don't do thee and thou, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I do.
They're not on that end of the spectrum. It's more colloquial. And I kind of took it as a, well, I'm almost like reading a translation of a work that happened in the deep past or happened in this other world, and it's more like it's translated for modern readers, which helped me kind of understand how the dialogue could work that way. And I found those books worked really well. I'm not sure what I'm asking here, but what are your thoughts on everything I just said? Do you think there is a shift to have the dialogue be more modern, even if it's in a more, you know, high epic setting?
Well, I'm gonna make a confession to start with, which is that while I know Brandon and I know Brent, I know Pat Rothfuss, who may also fall into the category. I know them, but I have not read their work. I have been reading a ton of urban fantasy in the last several years, and so have missed out on some of the epic stuff and need to go back to it. But I'm doing a lot of reading in my own genre right now, and my own genre these days is urban. And so I really can't speak to the effectiveness of what they're doing, but certainly they seem to be, you know, they're highly successful. Their works are get terrific reviews and devoted readership, so they must have hit upon something that's working for them very well. I think for me, my historical background might be a handicap in this way. I think I would find it hard to write in a medieval setting or a quasi-medieval setting, but use language that was too colloquial for my tastes. I would find that difficult. And actually, one of the challenges I had in writing Thief Taker was having my characters sound like they belonged in 18th century Boston, while also trying to maintain that hard-boiled, edgy, urban fantasy voice that I was going for the book. I think that to a certain degree I had to compromise in both respects, and sometimes I think the dialogue might be less edgy and urban than some of my readers would like, and I think at times it might be a little too modern for some of my other readers. But it was a balance I was trying to strike as I was working on it, because character voice in dialogue is incredibly important to setting a sense of place and time for a reader. So I kind of punted on that question a little bit, but that was the best I could do.
Well, it's a tough question, and it's something that genre authors have struggled with, I would think, from the beginning of genre literature. I mean, when you think about just watching an episode of Star Trek and an alien species speaking English so clearly and speaking as a modern American, what is that balance between trying to create cultural distinctiveness and create character through dialogue, but at the same time, keeping the book accessible to as many readers as possible so you can make a living and have a readership.
Right, right. And that accessibility, that last point, is really key, because 21st century readers, and this is not a bad thing, but 21st century reader, they want to be immersed in story and place, but they also want the work to be accessible to them. They want it to flow. And it's hard to do that. And we authors rely on dialogue a great deal to establish character, to establish plot and all of those things. And so we want our characters to speak in a way that doesn't pull our reader out of the story, but by the same token doesn't frustrate our reader because it's hard to read. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are some fantasy novels, I won't say who, but the dialogue went so far with the formal aspect of it and almost like the stylized vision of what dialogue should be versus what it was, that I couldn't read the book. And it just totally yanked me out of any possible story. So yeah, it's a tough balance. I think you said there are going to be 5 books in this series. Is that right?
I don't know yet how many books there are going to be.
There
is certainly the second book, which is called Thieves' Quarry, will be out next year, right around the same time this one came out, so probably June or July. And that one is already written. It's with my editor. I should be getting revisions soon, or editorial notes soon, so that I can do revisions. The third and fourth books in the series are in proposal form right now, and we're hoping to have them contracted before the end of the year. And after that, I'm not sure yet. I would like to continue writing Thief Taker books. I really, really enjoy the characters. I enjoy the time period. That said, I also have other projects underway and want to work on those as well. So I don't know yet how big the series will wind up being.
You just ticked my wife off big time, by the way, since she has to wait till June. Are you still going to be writing books under David B. Coe?
I don't know. I don't know. Right now, as I say, I'm really enjoying the epic, the urban fantasy stuff, and the other projects I'm working on are also urban fantasies. So, I don't know if I would write those. They're contemporary urban fantasies, so they're different from Thief Taker. So I don't know if I would write them as David B. Coe or as D.B. Jackson or as a third, as yet to be named entity, who would then have to be introduced to readers yet again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess with every different sub-genre, you have to face that question, you know. I look at someone like, I know Dan Simmons, he's a bit of an exception, I guess, because not everyone does this, but he writes in 4 or 5 different genres, and I'm not sure how many readers follow him from genre to genre. What has your experience been? Because I know you've been open about your pen name. It's not like you haven't hidden it or anything. So what has your experience been about the David B. Coe readers coming over and reading Thief Taker and giving you feedback on it?
I have, generally speaking, I have had pretty good success with getting the David B. Coe readership to come over to D.B. Jackson. And the vast majority of them do seem to enjoy the new work as well as the old. But I will say that I have had readers tell me, you know, I enjoyed Thief Taker. It was a fun read. I really like the multi-book great big fantasies. Mm. And so, you know, when are you going to write one of those again? And I also know that D.B. Jackson is attracting readers who probably never would have looked at David B. Coe books because they're drawn either to the urban fantasy angle or to the historical angle or both. But I definitely have had readers say to me, you know, I've never read anything else you've done, but this is great. Do you have more stuff like this? And I basically have to say, well, I do, but it's on the way.
Right.
I have friends who have written under one name in several genres. I have one friend, his name is A.J. Hartley, and he has been a New York Times bestseller as a thriller writer. He has a terrific YA fantasy out now. He wrote epic fantasy for Tor and is now working on Shakespearean novelizations that are also doing incredibly well. So he's like some of the other people you mentioned in this way. He just seems to thrive in any genre, and part of it is he's just so good at what he does.
Hmm. I know you're going to be at Dragon Con pretty soon. Can people find you there, or what are you going to be doing at Dragon Con?
Yeah, I will be there as D.B. Jackson, and I will be, I'm on six or seven different panels. I will be doing a reading on Sunday afternoon, probably either from one of the Thief Taker books or one of the Thief Taker short stories. I'm also going to be in the dealer's room. I'm in a booth with some other authors, and I'll be selling copies and signing copies of Thief Taker as well as some of my David B. Coe fantasies. And we'll have Thief Taker t-shirts and all of that. I should be very easy to find at Dragon Con, and I hope to see as many folks there and spend time talking to fans. That's why we do conventions, because it's a great opportunity to meet and chat with the people who are reading our books, and I love doing conventions.
And your website is dbjackson.com, right?
Actually, it's not. That will get you to a realtor in Kansas, I believe. and I'm not making that up. What you want is dbjackson-author.com.
Okay. All right. Those realtors, you can't trust those people, I tell
you.
Well,
you know, I mean, it's the guy's real name, so I guess I really can't begrudge it to him. But I feel like, hey, you know, this is my pseudonym. Find your own, man.
David, it's been really great having you on the show. I know we hit on a lot, but is there anything that you wanted to mention that I didn't ask you?
Not really, no. I mean, the one thing I'd say is if folks can't make it to Dragon Con, I will be guest of honor at Constellation in Huntsville, Alabama later this fall, and guest of honor at MarsCon in Williamsburg, Virginia in January. So I should be pretty easy to find over the next several months.
And folks, you don't know this, but David and I had a heck of a time getting the together on this. And I always record everything through my laptop, and my laptop just died. And so I couldn't use my equipment because it had to be with XP. My new computer is Windows 7, and it has just been a wreck. So, David, thank you for your patience and letting me cancel on you last minute on Sunday, as I couldn't figure out a solution to fix all of this.
It was no problem. I think I might have canceled on you at least twice in this process, so it's no problem at all. I'm glad we finally did it, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
The book is Thief Taker. Win a copy right now by coming to adventuresinscifipublishing.com and following the contest rules on the homepage. And if you don't win a copy, then please go out to your local bookstore and buy one, or get your e-reader version online. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.